Welcome to Albert Camus Radio. This is a very interesting episode you're about to listen to. It's the first round of questions and answers amongst the scholars at the 2021 Albert Camus Society annual meeting. So papers have been given, and if you listen to these episodes in chronological order, you'll hear the papers that led up to this question and answer session. And in this episode, you'll hear the various scholars that attended the meeting engaging one another on these topics. So I always feel at academic conferences, this is where the real action and progress is made. The scholar lays out her paper, for instance, and then the other scholars have already had a chance to absorb it, consider it, and they really help push the paper in a new direction, in a better direction, in a continued momentum in the way the scholar was going, adding things that may be missing, pointing out inconsistencies, asking very good questions. And you revise your work after these question and answer sessions. So enjoy this episode of some of the very best, if not the collection of the current best scholars on Camus in the world, engaging one another on topics that they've just considered. Have we questions? I have one for George. I love the list of, I didn't print your paper, so I love the list that had possible justifications or motivations, the one that was number 12, post-colonial. I think that's a really important area to start opening up, and I think Camille Dowd certainly leads the way on opening that post-colonial reading of The Stranger from sort of the genesis of Algeria itself. In that list, are there options in there that justify the action in any sense?
Whoa. That's the legal question on which everything should turn. I personally do not regard what Meursault did as an act of self-defense. I don't think that one can justify it as an act of self-defense. In the last year, when I gave the skeleton, the outline of my thoughts, and then, as I said, this is the prose version so far, at least, I listed a number of legal cases, especially very controversial ones, the Jordan Davis Michael Dunn case from 2012 to 14. But, you know, since then, there are much more interesting cases that have come along. And I mentioned two of them in my remarks, although they're not in the paper. And the one is obviously the case of Kyle Rittenhouse, who as a 17-year-old went to a demonstration armed with an assault rifle and found himself then put upon, set upon, and committed two killings. I'm not going to go out on a limb here and even say really what I think about that, but it's pretty clear, and I said at one point in the paper that nothing really turns in terms of premeditation on whether Meursault, when he went back to the beach on the third trip, knew that the Arab was going to be there or not. So we can take him at his word. He didn't know that the Arab was going to be there. He thought that the whole thing was over and done with. On the way back to the bungalow with Raymond, Raymond was actually talking about going back, to town, right? So as far as Meursault was concerned, the whole thing was over and done with. But the key is what he did once he was back on the beach. So it's not the intent that he had in mind when he left the bungalow, right, and went back to the beach on the third trip. It's what he did after that. And the pause, and that's, I think, why the examining magistrate is absolutely right to focus on it, right? To dwell on it, as Meursault says. Yeah, I mean, that does make all the difference between a case of justifiable self-defense on the one hand and premeditated murder on the other. And it's interesting too, and this is the case of Michael Dunn and Jordan Davis, the Florida case, Jacksonville case of 2012. You know, Dunn, it's called the loud rap music case, right? So Dunn asked the teenagers to turn down the volume on the rap music. They didn't do it. He went into his glove compartment. He got out his Glock. He unsafetied it, whatever you call that. He unsafetied it. He pointed it. He fired 10 shots. You know, you could say that that was not, I mean, it was obviously not a case of self-defense. Clearly, it was a case of premeditation. So Michael Dunn didn't go to the convenience store looking for, you know, black youths to kill. He didn't know they were going to be there. But what he did in those seconds, right, in opening his car door, going into his glove compartment, opening it, getting the gun out of the holster, you know, de-safetying it, and then pointing it, that clearly, that those are all the component parts of premeditation. And they can go very quickly. A lot of people think premeditation has to involve, you know, like planning the night before or something like that. It can, but it doesn't have to. So, in terms of justification, I think it's the post-colonial aspect of it is very strong. I have a paragraph in there that I didn't read, where this is on page, it's up on screen, it's up on the screen now. I could screen share it. Hang on a sec. No, can I screen share it? Yeah. Yep. Go ahead. Watch. Let me find it again. Is that the one? Yeah. Okay. There it is. One way to assess Meursault's intellectual abilities to examine his prejudgments about and prejudices against others, especially subalterns. So a citizen of Algeria and a resident of Algiers, but one of French ancestry and thus a member of a dominant minority. Meursault was a child of his culture. He recounts that the first thing that he did after learning that Raymond's mistress was an Arab was to write the terrible letter, right? Would he have written it had she been French? That the group of Arabs outside his building were staring at us, right? In silence, but in that way of theirs, as if we were nothing but stones or dead trees, projecting onto and into them the hate stare, right? As we would call it. That the Arabs on the beach were wearing greasy overalls, right? So they're unclean. That the second Arab was blowing into a little reed, but could only get three notes out of his instrument. So, like, you know, he's uncultured. He can't do music, right? And that that this Arab too was carrying a knife. This is a detail that I just saw a couple of weeks ago. Like, you know, then that one exchange on the second trip to the beach, it's like, you know, that other one draws his knife. Like, what? I mean, we've only seen one knife so far, but they're Arabs, you know, they all carry knives, right? Like it's just Meursault's mentality is just really very colonial, if you like. So,
That's why I was particularly interested in number 12, because the way I've always read it is there seems to be this subtext of like, look, if you would just play ball with us, this can go away because you killed an Arab. You know, you have a distinct legal advantage here. And if you get your act together.
Help us out. Help us help you. Yeah. I mean, there's a literature. I think Megan is more aware of this than I am. But there's a literature on the absurdity of an Algerian of European French ancestry being charged with murder for having killed an Arab Algerian, right? In other words, that's part of the absurdity of the trial. That they're doing what? So in the end, a Frenchman is going to be, you know, beheaded for having killed an Arab. I mean, that's absurd on the face of it, right? So that's part of probably Camus' own thinking, I would think, here. But then we get into the tricky question, really tricky question of differences between Camus' colonial mentality and Meursault's colonial mentality. Yeah. If I may, I have a question for Tom. And I really appreciate, you know, your description of you know, the various manifestations of the absurd. I'm struck by the fact that the word absurd occurs only once in the French text of The Stranger. And it's pretty clear, I think, that Meursault has some experience of the absurd, but he's not like putting it in, he's not conceptualizing it, all right? And this distinction between the absurd as a feeling, the feeling of the absurd, and the, as you call it, the experience of the absurd, is really important. I was wondering, do you think that, although I probably have experience of the absurd as the genus, and then the feeling of the absurd and the idea of the absurd as the species under it. But do you think that Camus' usage of the absurd in the myth of Sisyphus is just plain too loose? In other words, that's overuse. I mean, he overuses the word. Like when you word search it and you see it occurring like 3 and 4 times a page, right? That I know this is kind of contrary to the conventional wisdom, that the idea is that Camus somehow he gave this semi-brilliant phenomenological description of the absurd in the Myth of Sisyphus. But when you go back and read it, it's awfully loose. It's not very precise at all. I mean, was that part of your motivation for trying to like get a handle on this?
Yeah, it was actually. I found the Myth of Sisyphus to be really compelling in the richness of all the absurdities described in there. And yeah, it is not without coincidence that he discusses how Kierkegaard proposes a response to absurdity, and Lev Shestov. And so he seems to conflate all these absurdities as some monolithic idea. And from that perspective, ask this question, well, should we kill ourselves? I mean, if absurdity can be defined as the desire for eternal life in the face of utter annihilation, for example, then, well, it seems absurd if we're going to kill ourselves even sooner than it, with death occurring anyway at some point. And at other points, there's this nostalgia for unity, for example, which I think is some sort of desire for one framework in which to fit the entirety of life, which is more epistemological. And then there's also the myth of Sisyphus. Well, if death is the most obvious absurdity, as Camus literally puts it, I mean, where's the absurdity in the myth of Sisyphus? Because that's part of his condemnation. It's eternal. He just never dies. So I find that somewhat inconsistent at points, although very rich, of course. So there are a lot of interesting absurdity to be discussed in their own right, but it is a variety, and I think it's Camus tends to think of it as a monolith. And for me, I think formally it's a monolith. It's the contradiction between an anticipation on the one hand and a reality on the other hand, but that doesn't tell us very much about what we are confronted with here.
I mean, if I can add something onto this, I mean, part of my paper was my investigations of the myth of Sisyphus, is that Camus is actually, he's really talking about the reverse of what you see in a lot of the commentaries. Like Camus isn't saying, he describes the absurd and he talks about our emotional response to awareness of the absurd. And the idea of his problem of suicide is that often misunderstood. Excuse me. His interest is really faced with this awareness of the absurd and our emotional response to the absurd. Why would we want to commit suicide? Not, you know, should we or ought we to commit suicide? And he invents this this idea, which he says possibly this only applies to three people, one of who's fictional, one of who's a legend, and the other, we don't even really know what happened to Lacia. Did he kill himself because of reflections on the absurd? But really, nobody, he's saying, feels that the absurd dictates death. And he's interested in sort of why. Like, how should we grasp the problem? And the problem is, you know, what can we do? How can we live our lives with this sort of awareness of the absurd? Do we just sort of ignore it? Or do we treat it like, for example, Socrates' Daemonon, Daemonion, this an insight, a revelation of something about human beings that we can actually put to use? And then in the Nietzschean sense, if we can find something about our history, about what it is to be a human, the only real interest that we should have in the Nietzschean view is what use we can put this to in the service of life. So Camus is saying that as human beings, because of the sort of thing people that we are, the species that we are, we feel, we have a bodily reaction to this idea of the absurd. It just comes to us. We have to respond to it. And sort of what can we do? So, you know, relatively small part of the myth of Sisyphus is just this sort of like philosophy of the absurd. And the latter part is, how can you create with the absurd? How can you put this to use for the service of life? And then he ends, of course, with the myth of Sisyphus, which is a sort of an active response, how Sisyphus lives his life with this knowledge. So I think that like George's original point of the absurd appears sort of quite a lot, and Camus not very clear. Well, he does offer a very twisty sort of turning way of talking about it, but his real interest is, how can we use the absurd, the knowledge, this wisdom we get through awareness of the absurd, to motivate ourselves into action? And like, why is it that we don't want to kill ourselves? Not why should we kill ourselves? And a lot of the commentary is sort of taking some Camus to task and investigating this. Why does he think that the absurd should make us want to commit suicide? Mm. When actually he's asking the opposite question.
Yeah, I completely agree that I might have misrepresented the initial point of departure of the myth of Sisyphus, but I think there is some kind of methodological consideration in the myth of Sisyphus where he differentiate between correct responses or potentially correct responses, because of course it's an individual subjective case in each and every case, but there are wrong kinds of responses, and suicide is one of them. That does not mean, of course, that suicide is a wrong thing to do, because there are, according to Camus, cases of suicide which can be fine, but yeah, suicide, which basically means annihilating the meaninglessness from which the problem arises. So yeah, I think there is a project of how should we respond, but maybe it's more negative than positive, in the sense that this is the way that we should respond to it, either suicide or acceptance.
Yeah, I think that's exactly right. I mean, he doesn't actually say, you know, this is what we should do. This is the starting point that he keeps talking about. And again, he is interested in suicide. Like you say, it's not really physical suicide he's interested in, but it's like what he calls philosophical suicide. Mm-hmm. And but then he does in the essay, like he establishes something and we think, and then he'll turn around and say something like, oh, but I really am interested in physical suicide. It's like, well, no, you're not. And then he tries to pack enormous amounts of material and ideas under headings like the problem of suicide. So the problem of suicide for Camus is a very complicated issue, which he tries to put an enormous amount under. But I think what you said there is right. I mean, Camus is basically saying awareness of the absurd shouldn't be and ought not to be a showstopper. We can, not only should we not be stopped from living our lives, we can actually use this in order to benefit our lives. But there are, like, I can't tell you the right thing to do. I mean, he does have the whole section on, you know, how do we create with the absurd? But here's definitely the wrong approach that he definitely goes into in Kierkegaard and the other sort of religious existentialists. They're going about it in the wrong way. And ultimately, his concern, and this is why it's sort of a political myth, and he does sneak it in a little bit at the end, his ultimate concern is once we've established that we can create these, what I'm calling myths, and what he's calling them myths as well, we can create these myths, would we then have a free reign to create any kind of myths that we want? And say, well, as long as this myth is in the spirit of the absurd and it propels me and motivates me forwards, well, we've seen the danger that these kind of myths can have. Fascist myths, for example, the communist myths. I mean, if what Camus is very, like, it pains to say, is it's not everything's absurd, so all is permitted. There has to be some restriction on the kind of myths that you can produce. And he doesn't really, in the Myth of Sisyphus, bother himself with the restrictions there and then, which is why a lot of people who've criticized the myth say things like, oh, well, you could embrace the absurd while being a mass murderer or something like that. Well, as it stands in the myth, that's sort of left open because this is the beginning point. But of course, he builds upon this in The Rebel, and really there starts to put a limitation on what sort of myths that we can have if they are, in the Nietzschean sense, in the service of life. And this is where he criticizes Nietzsche as well. So really, the myth of Sisyphus, although it doesn't explicitly lay it out, Camus is laying the grounds for we can be motivated into action with our awareness of the absurd. We can create true myths or myths that aren't true or false, but we are limited. There is a limited range of myths that are faithful to the absurd. We can't just have any motivating myth whatsoever because that's philosophical suicide.
Yeah, I agree. I think I don't have anything to add myself, but there's another quote in The Myth of Sisyphus, which really spells out those, what Camus calls the commandments. I'm looking for it right now. So I think in my edition on page 34, 35, he says, and carrying this absurd logic to its conclusion, I must admit that struggle implies a total absence of hope, which has nothing to do with despair, a continual rejection, which must not be confused with renunciation, and a conscious dissatisfaction, which must not be compared with to immature unrest. Everything that destroys, conjures away, or exercises these requirements, and to begin with, consent, which overthrows divorce, ruins the absurd and devaluates the attitude that may then be proposed. So I think that's one of the central criteria for a response to the absurd and the confinements in which we find ourselves in terms of how to act. And that holds, I think, for political myth as well.
I agree.
It's good, I think, that the distinction between, I'll call it ordinary suicide and philosophical suicide is extremely important, because as I read the myth, Camus is actually dismissive of, say, physical ordinary suicide as an answer to the absurd, as a response to it. But he's much more concerned with philosophical suicide because, and here, obviously, we have to include not only his critique of Kierkegaard and all the people he calls the existentials, right? But also the phenomenologists, right? He thinks of all of these kind of these otherworldly approaches to the absurd to be not only to fail, but to be somehow reprehensible intellectually, at least, certainly probably even morally, I guess. But you know, his critique of Husserl and the phenomenologists, as he called them. So, and of course, we can debate about how solid Camus' knowledge, his understanding of the phenomenologists and Husserl was. But nonetheless, he's very sensitive to any approach that involves some sort of leap to another world that beckons as a world of sense, as a world that anesthetizes us against the absurdity of this world. And he's very hard on the philosophers whom he regards as inviting us to commit along with them philosophical suicide. So, and I find that actually praiseworthy on his part. I disagree about some of the philosophers named there, but I mean, certainly Kierkegaard had it coming in a sense, because I mean, a number of my pious Christian friends have a lot of contempt for Kierkegaard for having made it sound like Christian faith is something that rests, is absurd, right? Christian faith is absurd, right? Which the my educated pious Christian friends deny. They don't believe that at all. And they think that Kierkegaard gives Christian faith a bad name. As did some of the early church fathers like Tertullian and a few others, but Augustine certainly didn't.
So George, by philosophical suicide, do you think that Camus merely means suicide committed within the domain of philosophers, of coming up with philosophical theories in a response to the absurd, to meaninglessness, or perhaps as I see it, as a sort of broader Megan, I thought you
actually
was down.
Yeah, it was. Yeah, Simon did a really nice job of stating what I was wanting to say. So
okay.
Continue. Thank you, Peter. Though.
Yeah. So is it broader than just coming up with a philosophical answer to absurdity, but also a way of living your life premised upon philosophical assumptions? I'm not sure if that makes any sense, but
yeah, I mean, I think it makes perfect sense. I mean, I don't think that you necessarily have to be, well, you certainly don't have to be a professional philosopher, an academic philosopher, a published philosopher, to engage in what in a broad sense could be called philosophical suicide. That's the easy way out. I think that in the broadest possible sense, what Camus is talking about in that section on philosophical suicide is what we could call today avoidance discourse. We can come up with alternative descriptions that eliminate the problem of the absurd from what we're talking about. And again, as I said before, anesthetize ourselves against it. I think that makes perfect sense to see it in a, Well, there's this debate about, you know, to what extent Camus himself was a philosopher. So I think we've had a number of sessions on that in the past. And the consensus here seems to be something like, well, he's not an academic philosopher, right? But he's certainly a philosopher, if by philosopher you understand someone who's committed to the love and pursuit of wisdom. So his work is very Socratic in that sense. So,
shall we break for the next 15 or so minutes and get started at the bottom of the hour with